Thanks for listening to Press Play. If you're like me and you need help navigating the busy film award season, I have a podcast just for you. It's called The Treatment, and it's hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And Elvis really goes beyond the simple plot outline to understand what inspires the people who make these movies, the actors, the filmmakers, the producers. So check it out, The Treatment, on KCRW's iTunes page. Today on Press Play, we celebrate Martin Luther King Day with Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, the first MLK biopic.
Dramas with a black protagonist by black directors are not top of the list of studio chiefs to greenlight. They're not sitting around thinking, which black filmmaker could we make a historical black drama with a black lead?
Then we talked to a historian of the Voting Rights Act who says that Selma got several things wrong, including the role of President Lyndon Johnson. And on a day commemorating an American dedicated to dialogue and nonviolence, we revisit a conversation between a former Nazi skinhead and the gay teen he savagely beat. The relationship they developed later in life is a testament to the power of forgiveness. Finally, Hector Tobar recounts the story of the 33 Chilean miners trapped thousands of feet below ground. That's all coming up after this news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Okay, let's press play.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest, that means march, that means disturb the peace, that means jail, that means risk, and that is hard.
If that Martin Luther King speech doesn't sound familiar, don't be surprised. Selma director Ava DuVernay didn't have the rights to King's actual words, so she wrote some herself. DuVernay talked about the making of the movie and about being a black female director in Hollywood on The Business with KCRW's Kim Masters.
You came from the world of publicity.
Yes.
You worked on projects for Steven Spielberg, Michael Mann, Clint Eastwood. What did you do for them in these films?
Well, I was a publicist. My specialty was hybrid films and niche campaigns where, you know, they were enlightened enough to know that the core audience was not just white men, that they had to reach women or LGBT people or black or brown or just being very aware that there are riches in the niches. So I would come in and do that work and cross it over back into the mainstream. A lot of strategic publicity.
And then I read that one day you were watching, I think it was it Michael Mann directing?
I was on the set.
The Collateral?
I was on the set of Collateral, yeah.
And you thought, I could do this.
Yeah, I was on the set of Collateral and we were shooting in East LA and I just, you know, had a story that I was aware of that happened just a few streets over because I'm from South Central LA, Compton area. So I almost immediately started tinkering on a script and became one of those many, many people who have a script in the drawer.
So you started out making a doc.
Yeah.
And it was a $10,000 budget, I think. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I just made it check to check. You know, as I would make money from my publicity clients, I would put it towards this doc that I was making about this group of artists in South Central LA who were doing innovative things with hip-hop and progressive movements in that area. It was a good way to begin picking up a camera and telling stories.
I saw that you had given a speech to it's something called Black Star, which I guess is a conference.
Oh, yes, that's a little-known tape. Yes. What did I say? Oh, my goodness.
You said you were talking to a predominantly African-American audience, and you were saying, as it was reported, that you were talking to this audience about how to find private money to finance
yes.
films. You said it's not about knocking on closed doors. It's about building our own house and having our own door.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm just really allergic to, you know, dealing in a permission-based way. I think that, you know, that is what the industry is. It's all about knocking on doors, permission, begging, please, can you help me? Can you do this for me? My idea is really good. Please say yes. And, you know, that's always a challenge for women filmmakers, for filmmakers of color. And I think being a publicist for so many years gave me insight into some of the way that the industry works. And so I didn't go into it bright-eyed, bushy-tailed as a filmmaker thinking everyone's going to think my idea is great and give me money. I went in with my eyes wide open, knowing that I was going to have to, you know, find my own way, as most independent filmmakers do. And yeah, so it's just about building, you know, our own systems and ways to do things, which is why I created a firm.
Don't necessarily go to Paramount, which is doing this movie, or Disney or Fox, and expect them to give you permission.
Well, it's just not their model. It can get personal. We can call it systemic. We can call it, you know, that there are racial overtones there, class overtones there, sexist overtones there. But the bottom line is, it is not their current business model. So do you not make your film? I mean, do you not do it? What do? You find another model. You find another way to do it. And so that was my goal. If you're waiting around for someone to change their mind in order for you to speak your mind, you're going to be waiting a long time.
So you moved on from there to doing dramatic film.
Yes.
I Will Follow.
Yes.
Did you say to yourself, now I am ready to do this?
Same idea. Took $50,000 that I've been saving for a house, and instead of buying a house, I bought a career. And yeah, I was able to kind of triple, or I think now quadruple that little bit of money, and then put it into the next one. So it was really just about, you know, taking a little bit of seed money and growing it from film to film, and just trying to find a way where they didn't seem like there was any way.
Where did you get that entrepreneurial Gene.
My dad. My dad has a small carpet and flooring company for all of my life, and I would see him go out very, very early in the morning when it was dark outside, get in a truck with his name on the side, and make his own way. And, you know, never got a paycheck, you know. I haven't had a paycheck, an actual check paid to me with taxes taken out, you know what I mean? That I didn't have to worry about where it was coming from. And I don't know, I guess it's almost 20 years now. But once you're in that entrepreneurial spirit, it's hard to go the other way.
So after I Will Follow, you moved on and made a bigger film, Middle of Nowhere. So you're just combining this enterprise with incredible pragmatism, really.
I think so. I mean, I think I went into this with my eyes wide open about what it was. You know, didn't have any big dreams to be making films at any high level. I know a lot of filmmakers want to get to that $20 million, $30 million, $50 million level, $100 million films, a success to them. The budget's escalating, going up each time. For me, you know, as a Black woman filmmaker, I just wanted to make films consistently. My goal was just to make a film or make something every year. You know, Spike Lee was a great example of that. He made a film every year for 20 years. He made commercials. He made docs. He made just was always shooting. So I think that, you know, idea of it doesn't have to be bigger. It just needs to be consistent. Gave me a different idea about, you know, focusing on work as a constant instead of as a ladder. And yes, I mean, by fluke, it has been a bit of a ladder, but it wasn't by design.
So you didn't necessarily say to yourself, I have to have a $50 million budget, but you did make a big leap with Selma. That was that's a $20 million film, a much different proposition. And it was a long gestation period. What about the story makes it so difficult to tell?
Dramas with a Black protagonist by Black directors are not top of the list of studio chiefs to greenlight. They're not sitting around thinking, which Black filmmaker could we make a historical Black drama with a Black lead? It's not top of the list. And so I think, you know, over the years, that's been one of the issues. But then also, you know, I mean, how do you approach such a big life? And what is that really? And what does it look like? And certainly, you know, the speeches and the estate were a stumbling block for some people to get around. You know, a lot of factors. You look at the foreign, the same old myth.
Right.
The same
black
old,
Black movies,
you know,
don't play foreign.
Yeah, this antiquated.
So-called Black movies, I should
that's
say.
That's right. Very antiquated. You know, in my view, ignorant, in that it is not progressive in any way. It's not moving forward. It's just the same old lie being repeated again and again. And so all that is a stew that made for a film with Dr. King at the center never being released in theaters. We are 50 years from the time that these events happened. There have been biopics about Jimmy Hoffa. I hear they're making one on the lady who created Tupperware. I'm sure she's lovely, but I think Martin Luther King Jr. should have one as well.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Bram, and you're listening to a conversation with KCRW's Kim Masters and Ava DuVernay. She's the director of the MLK biopic, Selma.
Now, you getting to this issue of the speeches. I mean, your Martin Luther King speaks in this emotional way, and it is known that you had to write all of it.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, the intellectual property wasn't available to us. So the question was, do we not tell the story? And so I just untethered myself from the words and really tried to get underneath what he was trying to say. King was a big ideas guy, real intellectual. The concepts are so advanced and really, really just amazing, amazing stuff when you read it. And so I thought if I could just get underneath the words to what he intended to say and communicate and share, I would be okay. And so finally, my mother was very happy because my English Lit African American Studies double major time at UCLA finally came in handy.
What are you going to do with that?
What are you going to do with that? Well, I'm going to rewrite some Dr. King. That's what I'm going to do, ma'am. And it all works.
That's awesome. I mean, that is daunting. I am going to be Martin Luther King's speechwriter posthumously.
That's right. It's daunting. But, you know, it was fascinating to get inside his head and to really sink myself into those speeches and go beyond the words and really – sometimes the words – obscured what he was trying to say because he was such a beautiful orator.
I mean, I think it would astonish people to think that something like a public speech that Martin Luther King made is not a public thing.
But he was not a public person. He was a private citizen. He was not the president of the United States. He's a leader that
doesn't feel like a private citizen.
He's a private citizen, and his work was copywritten. And so, yeah, everything that we use of Lyndon Johnson is public record. And he was the president of the United States, but King was a preacher from Atlanta, and his works are private.
So when he meets with Lyndon Johnson, as he does more than once in your film, did you have to make up his words and use Johnson's?
I mean, it's a film, so it's everything is dramatized and fictionalized.
But Johnson record some of that stuff?
Yeah. Some of his phone calls in the White House I recorded over the time of his presidency, which spans, you know, far beyond the 3 months that we focus on. So
Right. There
are not a lot that were during our time, but it was great to listen to them talk to each other because I got a sense of the relationship and the way that they dealt with one another. And we did put a lot of that into the work that David Oyelowo does with Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah, it's very, watching him, Martin Luther King, pressure Lyndon Johnson,
yes,
who is a formidable figure in
That's
his
right.
own right, is quite a drama.
Yes.
And, you know, so many filmmakers seem to gild lilies. And maybe with Martin Luther King, you feel like, A, there's no need. As often, I think there's no need in these dramatized versions of reality. And also, it's almost sort of a sacred story.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in previous scripts that I'd read and other filmmakers are trying to approach in the way that they're trying to approach this story, he's either a saint or it's a takedown. It's an overcompensation on both sides. He was a man. He was a human being. He had foibles. He was a man of faith who was sometimes unfaithful. He was guilty. People died on his watch during this time, this 3 month period. He had an ego. He was a human being like all of us.
Well, and I think, show a very political mind.
Well, and he was a strategist.
How to make this work?
Exactly right. He was a strategist. He was a tactician. He was an intellectual. I think that there's been this dumbing down of King, this homogenization of the civil rights movement, where everyone was a saint and they came in peace and then they died. And, you know, that's a disservice to what really happened there. They were radicals. And there were, you know, very, very intricate concepts behind the idea of nonviolence. It was brave. It was bold. And it wasn't just kind of lay down and get hit. There was much more behind it. And so
if the film
does anything, I hope it shows that. Yes.
It certainly does.
Good.
Yes. I do. I just will return for a second on this issue of the family. Was there an appeal made to the family?
No, we didn't reach out. They're not available. All of the rights to his speeches and his intellectual property are with another filmmaker. As a courtesy, we reached out to the family. We let them read the script in advance just so they knew what we were making. But there were no changes made and no changes asked for by them.
So the black question and the woman question, I always feel...
Okay, let's do it.
I always have a slight pang.
Time to do
when
it.
When I ask a woman, because I feel like, you know, a lot of women just are like, can I just make a film? Can I just be black? Can I just... But I don't think you can. I don't even think you necessarily feel that you should.
And I respect people who feel that way. Certainly, I completely respect that point of view. It's just not my point of view. There's some black filmmakers that don't want to be called black filmmaker. They just want to be a filmmaker. Some women that just want to be called a filmmaker, not a woman filmmaker. I'm a black woman filmmaker. That's my identity. That's the gaze through which I make my work. It doesn't mean that only black women can watch my work. I think it's ridiculous to think that people, folks are grown. Look, we're all adults. We all should be at a point right now that you can listen to stories from all kinds of minds and all kinds of folk. And so I believe in the good of people. I don't think that I'm limiting myself by calling myself what I am.
Of course. You've already made history. You're the first African-American woman to be nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Director.
Yes.
So
that's what I'm told.
There's the opportunity. I mean, kind of a shame it took this long, but congratulations.
Yeah, it's bittersweet in that way. You know, you're not the first woman deserving of it. But yeah, no, it feels good. I won't lie. I certainly hope. And I know that I'm the first, but not the last. There are a lot of amazing women out there doing beautiful things. So the hope is that, you know, no one else has to answer this question anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd like not to have to ask it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, talking with KCRW's Kim Masters. Coming up, some historians disagree with Selma's portrayal of LBJ as a president who had to be forced to support the Voting Rights Act. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Today is Martin Luther King Day, and we're using the opportunity to talk about Selma, the new movie that talks about King's push for voting rights. Some historians have taken issue with the film's portrayal of how the Voting Rights Act came about, specifically how the film portrays President Lyndon Johnson as being opposed to King's efforts. Here to help us look at the historical accuracy of the movie is Gary May. He's a professor of history at the University of Delaware and author of the book Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. Gary May, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. The movie portrays Johnson as, well, at the very least, reluctant in supporting voting rights, and that King had to argue repeatedly with the president to introduce voting rights legislation and to introduce it quickly. How accurate is the movie's interpretation?
On the Johnson-King relationship, it's rather warped. Let me give you an example. When I saw the film in an early screening on November 17th, the audience was, I think, young internet film critics and bloggers. And after Johnson had a few minutes of screen time, the next time he came on, the audience hissed him. So for whatever Ava DuVernay's intent was in her portrayal of Johnson, whether, you know, it was intentional or unintentional, it seems that Johnson is being perceived as a villain in the film, and that is absolutely inaccurate. The most serious inaccuracy is the film's very strong implication that Lyndon Johnson conspired with J. Edgar Hoover to create this sex tape, which would smear Martin Luther King and ruin his career. And actually, the letter that accompanied that tape called King a fraud and a pervert and suggested that he commit suicide. Lyndon Johnson had nothing to do with the creation of that tape. It's entirely an FBI project. But when you're watching the film, you see a scene with Johnson meeting with J. Edgar Hoover, and they're both sort of complaining about King, and the next scene is Coretta Scott King listening to that tape. Mm-hmm. So it's inescapable.
Right, the connection. And from what I understand, that tape and the letter, I think, were actually mailed a lot earlier, before January, I think in December.
That is right. She actually heard it two months earlier.
Well, you know, a lot of people say you can take artistic license. This is a feature film. It's not a documentary with details such as this. However, there is a strong implication in the movie about a central fact in this movie that President Johnson was very reluctant to introduce voting rights legislation, and that he was the foil to King in the movie. That's how it's portrayed, that he was King's opponent. And I want to play a recording of a phone call between Johnson and King on the subject of voting rights. This phone call took place January 15th, 1965.
You can find the worst condition that you run into in Alabama, Mississippi, or Louisiana, or South Carolina. And if you just take that one illustration and get it on radio and get it on television, get it on in the pulpits, get it in the meetings, get it every place you can, pretty soon the fellow that didn't do anything but follow, drive a tractor, he'll say, well, that's not right, that's not fair. And then that will help us on what we're going to shove through in the end. And if we do that, we'll break through as it'll be the greatest breakthrough of anything, not even accepting this 64 Act. I think the greatest achievement of my administration.
All right, so that's President Johnson talking about the Voting Rights Act with Martin Luther King. Ava DuVernay has said, in response to the historical criticism of the movie, that Johnson was a reluctant hero. He was cajoled and pushed. He was protective of a legacy. I'm quoting a statement she made. He was not doing things out of the goodness of his heart. But in that tape, it doesn't sound like he's reluctant at all. He says that this will be the greatest achievement of his administration.
That's right. I mean, he was actually very enthusiastic about it. In the film, the meeting between Johnson and King of December 14th, 1964 is depicted, and Johnson in the film is complaining that he just can't do it, and he's got to wait, and I don't know if it's the scene where he says, I've got 101 things to worry about, and you have only one. Well, that day, December 14th, 1964, Johnson asked his attorney general to begin drafting a Voting Rights Act. Now, we don't see that in the film. So Johnson is only seen as resistant and obstructionist. The tape you played is additional evidence that Johnson was supportive of what King was doing. Their differences were basically over timing. Johnson felt that because 6 months earlier in July of 64, he had signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 into law, which was a very controversial act, desegregating hotels, motels, movie theaters, and the like in the South, that the country and the Congress weren't quite ready for another major civil rights bill. He wanted to do it, but the moment had to be right. And he speaks to that in that telephone conversation. So he really, if not publicly supportive of demonstrations and that kind of divisive activities, he understands that what King is doing is creating really a morality play in Selma. You've got the villain is Sheriff James Clark, and the result will be an incident that will touch the conscience of the nation and the Congress and give Johnson the political moment to submit that bill to the Congress.
So the truth is a lot more nuanced than the movie has portrayed or previous movies have portrayed. And I guess one thing that the director didn't want to do was to present a movie in which President Johnson was the hero.
Well, the sad fact is that Hollywood has shied away from civil rights movies and movies about Martin Luther King. And one of the triumphs of this film is that it's really the first film about King and the civil rights movement that finally puts African Americans at the center of the story. They are the heroes in their own history. So it's understandable that they are sensitive to what seems to them, one African-American scholar puts it this way, the creation of a white savior narrative favoring LBJ. So if it's a matter of emphasis that you want, I would say that the black heroes are the ones that really risked everything, their homes, their jobs, and very often their lives. Johnson was risking his political reputation.
When you see a film like this, and it's obviously in your wheelhouse, and you wrote a book about the very event, What do you think when you come out of the movie theater and you see the facts distorted in the way that you've described?
I'm troubled because, as a historian, I know that movies have become the great teachers. So I think when you're making a film about real events and real people, you have to hold an artist to a higher standard of accuracy than if they were making a film about some fictional story. But I was very excited when Ava DuVernay became the director of Selma. She talked about the film as one that would not only talk about Martin Luther King, portray Martin Luther King in a new way, but it would also focus on the Selma voting rights movement. Often she said, and continues to say, the title of this film is Selma, not King. The film is a love letter to the Selma voting rights movement. And what disappointed me more than anything when I left the theater was, where are Selma's teachers, black teachers, who were reluctant to become involved in the voting rights movement because their jobs depended upon white school boards? They could lose their job. But their students shamed them into becoming involved. They said, how can you teach us government when you can't vote? And so one day in January, Selma's teachers, dressed as if they were going to church, marched on the registrar's office, waving toothbrushes, a sign that they were content to go to jail for several days if they had to. What about Selma's students, who also marched on the registrar's office and were forced marched out of town by Sheriff Clark's troops, beaten with billy clubs, shocked by electric cattle prods? If she had depicted those two moments in the history of the Selma voting rights movement, I probably would not have written a critical word about the film.
Right. I mean, and that is something that Martin Luther King had said, of course, repeatedly, that this wasn't about him. Civil rights movement was
yes.
about many more people than just one.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
One great man.
Yes.
Well, Gary May, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Gary May teaches history at the University of Delaware, and he's author of the book Bending Toward Justice, The Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. Coming up, a young Nazi skinhead severely beats a gay teenager. What happens when they meet years later is a remarkable tale of reconciliation. That story is next on Press Play after this news update.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the short documentaries nominated for an Oscar last year was called Facing Fear. It's about what happens when a Nazi skinhead meets the gay man he savagely beat 25 years before, when they were teenagers. The skinhead is Tim Zoll. One night, he and a group of his friends attacked Matthew Boger, who was living on the streets in Hollywood.
I remember looking into that face. I remember looking at that mohawk and those eyes.
I kicked him in the forehead, and he was out.
Matthew survived the attack, although he still has prominent scars on his face. Tim went home that night not knowing if Matthew was alive or dead. 25 years later, they met by chance and then, incredibly, became friends, close friends. That story is told in a documentary called Facing Fear. Earlier, I spoke with the director of that documentary, Jason Cohen, along with Tim Zoll and Matthew Boger, all three here in the studio. All right. Well, let's start with you two, Tim and Matthew, and talk about the moment that you met. How did you meet again all those years later?
Well, I had been at the Museum of Tolerance for quite a few years doing presentations, and Matthew had come onto the scene as a
volunteer.
And over a cup of coffee, basically, we were asking each other about, you know, where'd you grow up and where'd you hang out? And it ended up that we used to hang out at the same place. And
in Hollywood.
In Hollywood, Okie Dogs. And I had stated that I stopped hanging out there because one night it got really violent. And so he started asking a thousand questions. And, you know, I started to get the feeling, uh-oh, what's going on here? And he actually stated, well, you realize that I was the person who was left in the alley. And I said, yeah, I kind of got that feeling already. And then we said our goodbyes, very uncomfortable and yeah. Okay, and we'll see you later. And we didn't see each other again for 2 weeks.
What was going through your mind, Matthew, when in that moment, when you realized that Tim was the guy who was kicking you and kicked you in the face?
Well, part of me was in disbelief. This can't be possible. But then, you know, at the same time, nobody knows what happened in that alley. I never talked about it. So the only one that knows is one of the 10 or 12 and me.
Neo-Nazis who were attacking you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Punk rockers, yeah.
So you were punk rock and
we were Nazi
white
punks,
supremacists.
Basically, we weren't involved with any organized hate groups or anything like that, but we were basically Nazi punks.
And how old were you?
17.
And how old were you?
I had just turned 14.
14.
Mm-hmm. I was 13 when my mom threw me out.
And your mom threw you out of your house because you were gay.
Right.
And then you became a street kid.
Yeah, I lived in the park for 4.5 years.
And you were a prostitute.
Yes. You know, it's funny. When Jason was doing the film, it was the first time I actually trusted anybody. I had never shared that part of the story. But for some reason, I had built this trust with him that I figured, well, he'll be sensitive about it. And it is part of the story. So, yes. Just it's kind of out of my mind. And then someone will say it. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
So, Jason, how did you come across this story and meet these two and decide to make a movie about it?
So I was introduced to these guys through a nonprofit called the Fetzer Institute that they do work around promoting awareness of love and forgiveness. And I was doing a larger project for them. And they sort of presented Matthew and Tim's project to me because they were doing some outreach with them at the Museum of Tolerance. And I just felt like it would make for a great film. And I felt like also that we really wanted to explore this process of forgiveness that they had been going through at this point for 6 years. And I felt like that there was something really interesting there that needed to be explored.
So 6 years, first of all, the first meeting was by chance,
right?
At that Okie Dogs when you were teenagers.
Right.
Was by chance. And then 25 years later, you meet again by chance.
Yep.
And so let's go back to that meeting. You meet and then you don't see each other for 2 weeks. And I imagine you're not feeling very forgiving.
No, I was not very forgiving in the beginning. What I was more, I could have ignored him and just sort of been sort of bitter and angry. Or I could have done what I did, which was I wanted to know why. What makes somebody think that that's okay? Why pick this little kid at a hamburger stand who they didn't even know me. They even talked to me before. So I started with the question of, I want to know why.
And what did you say?
To why? Oh, well, the main thing was is that we were on a rampage and he was at our hangout and somebody had across the street had shouted, look, there's the faggots. Let's kill the faggots. And we went for it and went on a rampage. And you also have to understand, prior to that incident, we had also been involved with several other altercations as well.
So it's 25 years ago. You've had a lot of time to think about this. That answer that you just gave, oh, I just happened to see a bunch of people that I didn't like, so I thought, let's go beat them up.
Oh, yeah.
Is that really my motivation? And did you think about, who am I that I would be the kind of person
now, yeah,
to
now,
do that?
Looking back now, I'm not the same person. And back when I was a kid, being involved with violence, it made me feel good. It made me feel strong. It made me feel like I was in control.
Made you feel like a man.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you see someone who challenges that idea of what a man is or should be, and it enrages you?
I think it was more fear. Hmm. More fear than anything.
Hence the title of the movie.
Yes.
Fear.
Yes. Part of it. I think, as both of these guys will talk about, there was a lot of fear in this process of forgiveness that they then had to go through, and for both of them equally.
And that process is difficult for a couple of reasons. One is, I wasn't sure I wanted to forgive him, you know? Like, why should I forgive him? You know, let him walk around with whatever.
But ironically, you're at the Museum of Tolerance, I know. Of all places.
I know. So, and the other part was, there's a grieving process to this, because I'm letting go of a very defining moment in my life, something that defined who I was for almost 30 years. So letting go of that is a challenge. Even though it's a negative and it's, you carry that with you, it's still, there's a grief that goes with letting go of part of your life. That's a defining thing. So there was a fear of, what am I going to be when I let this go? Who will I become? And so it took a few years to get through this whole process. And the entire time we were working together doing the Hato presentation, that whole process of forgiveness and grief and letting go and growth all came from us working together. And it's almost like, Tim and I will tell you, like in the beginning, it was almost like working through the issue in front of the audience.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yes, because we're telling and sharing the story.
Therapy.
And we're watching their reaction back to us, and then we're growing through it.
Yeah. And in the film, you'll see that without that presentation, without them doing it, they probably wouldn't be where they are today. It forced them to kind of confront each other in a very open way.
Repeatedly.
Therapy with an elephant in the room.
Well, what was it about having to do this in front of an audience that helped you get through it?
Well, for me, you know... And it's something that I still deal with today, is the guilt, my own guilt. You know, people would ask, have you forgiven yourself? And it became this tumultuous thing to the point where I didn't even want to go do the presentation. But I forced myself to do it, because generally after the presentation, I've talked about it. And then I go home and I've processed through it. And then there's other times when I would leave and I had to process through it with somebody else because I was still left with a self-hatred or
Do you still have that?
Every once in a while, yeah. There's still guilt there. But it comes and goes. It'll probably always be there.
It feels like it's almost better to be you in this situation now.
Well, I wouldn't... Yeah, I mean...
Because you don't have to forgive yourself.
I don't. I mean...
And that's,
you know,
maybe the hardest thing
to
do.
There were multiple players that I had to forgive in this entire story, which Jason captures in the film. Even doing the presentation stuff, there was things I never discussed. One of them we've already talked about. The other one is I never really went into depth about my mom and that whole back and forth with forgiving my mom.
Who kicked you out of the
who
house.
Who kicked me out of the house.
For being gay.
Yes.
Were you ever able to forgive her?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My mom was an easier process than Tim was, believe it or not, once I was able to get to a point of understanding that she really, in her mind, had no other choice. In her mind, with her information, with her, what was out there at that time about sexuality, she really had no other choice.
She was a staunch Catholic.
She was Catholic. That was part of it. The other part, she felt she was protecting her other children from this disease.
Mm. So you two go around... and make presentations mm-hmm. to young people. And Tim, I'm wondering if you had been sitting in the audience and two people came and made a presentation like you two do, and you were a skinhead boy at the time, what would have been your reaction?
I have no clue, but I do know when I was that age, anybody over the age of 25 was full of it.
So how do you get through to young people then?
The truth, and by being transparent and honest and open. They know when someone's playing them.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, kids today are more educated, and whether that's because of the internet or they're just exposed to so much more. I mean, we've gone out to a few schools and shown the film, gotten a great reaction, and you know, we tell the kids this happened in 1980, and there was no gay role models on TV. There was no anti-bullying campaigns and things like that. So they're obviously much more educated. That being said, we made the film because we knew these topics were still relevant and we knew that it would still strike a chord with people and they still do need to be addressed.
So you two are friends now?
Our friendship is very familial and we work extensively together and we travel together. There's a moment again that Jason captures in Facing Fear, which is when my partner was terminally ill and Tim so gracious. It was at our ranch in Northern California, so Tim would actually fly up there to spend a weekend or as much time as he possibly could, just so I had someone to talk to, you know, because we were alone on this 20-acre ranch in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, I have my terminally ill partner who really couldn't communicate. So other than watching massive amounts of TV, I had Tim to come up and then sort of knock me around and like, we're going to get out. You have to get out of the house. Go breathe some air.
So you are like family to each other now.
Yeah. You know, I trust Tim with my life and with my secrets and with my thing. And
the man who almost killed you.
Right. And I'll let you talk about the line that's in the film. That
well, I think you pretty much, he says, you know, he trusts him with his life and he's a man who was willing to take his life.
Yeah.
So
it's a remarkable story.
It is. And I'm glad that he captured it the way, Jason captured it the way that he did in those 23 minutes. It's not a lot of time to capture that story, but I think he did a fantastic job. So
absolutely.
Which is probably why we're sitting here.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you all very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Matthew Boger, Tim Zoll, and Jason Cohen, the director of the Oscar-nominated short documentary, Facing Fear. All right, and in just a few minutes from now, To the Point is on with Warren Olney, who's here to give us a preview. Hello.
Hello. We are going to rebroadcast a program we did right after the police shooting of Michael Brown and the beginning of all the debate nationwide about police bias against, alleged bias, I should say, against black people. It's very interesting. And among those that we will have on is the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who has really changed that organization's attitude toward this whole issue.
Okay. Look forward to that very important discussion on this MLK Day. Thank you, Warren Olney.
Okay.
And coming up on this program, more than 4 years ago, 33 miners in Chile walked out of a mine that had collapsed. The whole world was watching. It was an unbelievable end to an unbelievable story. We're going to talk about how those miners survived underground for more than 2 months. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. October 13th, 2010, the entire world was watching. Improbably, almost impossibly, 33 Chilean miners emerged unharmed from the stone prison that had held them captive for 69 days. 2 months earlier, the century-old San Jose mine issued its final death rattle, a massive piece of rock over 45 stories high and more than twice the weight of the Empire State Building imprisoned the 33 miners more than 2,000 feet underground. What happened in the first days after the mine's collapse has never been revealed until now. Each of the 33 miners shared their version of events for the first time with writer and reporter Hector Tobar. His new book is Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. And he's here now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So take us down into the mine those first couple of days. The mine collapses. The 33 men are trapped inside, and there is very, very, very little to eat.
Yes. The mine is 2,000 feet deep. It's basically as deep as the tallest building is tall in the world. And so they were near the bottom, and there's a room there called the refuge, El Refugio, which is supposed to be there in case of an emergency, but really was their break room. It was where they had, you know, some food supplies, emergency supplies, but also there was fresh air pumped into there. So it was a cooler place to hang out because the temperature at that part of the mine could be 98 degrees with 100% humidity. And so they were in this room, and that's where they went to go look at their supplies. And they had enough food for 25 people to last 2 days, but there are 33 people. And that was already bad enough, but the very first night that they were trapped, many of the men were hungry. So some of the men said, let's eat. And they broke open the cabinet, which was locked, and they stole a good chunk of the food. And so the food was basically was cookies, cans of tuna, one can of peas, a few bottles of water. And then when the other men came back down, who ended up becoming the leaders, they said, you know, what have you guys done? You know, we're going to be here for days. We're trapped. You don't know what's happened. And so, yes, right from the very beginning, they were in very, very bad situation in terms of food supplies.
And tell us about the ration. Their ration was meager.
Yeah. It was very quickly decided that they would have one cookie a day, and they would have a glass of water that would have one spoonful of tuna in it. The water was industrial water that was down there with them that they actually used to keep the drills from, you know, overheating. So the water was already tainted with motor oil, and that was their daily meal. And so they began to lose a lot of weight. Most of the men lost 20 or 30 pounds in those first 2.5 weeks.
Wow. So what happened as the days went on and they didn't know if the outside world was going to reach them or not? They didn't know how long they would be there. What did they do to occupy their days, and how did they avoid turning on each other?
On the second or third night, one of the men, Mario Sepulveda, who ended up becoming a leader of them, even though he was very, very low in the hierarchy of the mine, he said he wanted to pray. In this sort of foul-mouthed call to prayer, he said, you know, God damn it, I want to pray. And all the men gathered and began to pray once a day at about noon. That would be also the same time that they ate. That was the one time they were all together, because they did begin to split into two groups. One group of men who was determined to try to find a way out or send a signal to the surface. Another group of men stayed in the refuge and did nothing and just waited. So the one time of day that they got together was for their prayer. And they kept together through that prayer and also by telling stories. Several of the men told me stories that they told of memories of big meals that they had, you know, many years earlier when they were young men. And then by the 13th or 14th day, many of them began to have very long and vivid dreams, in which very often they visited family members, or they took long walks through their hometowns, or in their dreams, they climbed through the mine to the surface and said, we're down here, come and find us.
So it didn't become a Lord of the Flies situation.
It did a little bit later, yes.
It kind of seemed to when they left the mine, when they were rescued.
Well, I think that even when the contact was made, what happened was they waited 17 days. After the third day, they began to hear drills coming toward them. These vibrations, it made a very, very distinct sound. I described it in the book as a rat-a-tat-tat, grind that the drills made. And so they could hear these drills getting closer to them, but then sometimes the drills would pass by and they could tell the drills had missed them and were going deeper down into the mine. So finally, one of the drills breaks through, and you know the first thing that's sent down is a telephone line, letters, and the men began to realize, while they were still trapped underground, the mountain is still in danger of further collapse, that they were the most famous miners on Earth, you know? And many of them believed they were going to become wealthy, because there was this Chilean entrepreneur who said that he wanted to make sure that they were all taken care of, that they would never have to work again. He immediately donated something like $10,000 to each of them, and he asked Chile to raise $1 million for each of the men, and it never happened. And so they believed they were going to be wealthy, and people who suddenly believe they're wealthy and famous, they began to argue with one another about who was going to take the credit, what they should do with the money, whether they were going to get it or not, whether it was even important. We shouldn't be discussing money. We're still trapped. We're going to be, you know, we might die down here. It's ridiculous to be talking about money or even contracts. So it did become a very divisive group after, I would say, the 40th or 50th day. Yeah.
So until then, before then, they were living in this kind of sealed off, literally sealed off hermetic world where they only had each other and God.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed a little more, even though they were facing starvation and possible death, that they were a more cohesive, dare I say, happier group.
Yes, they were united.
In fact,
the men thought of that as the most precious thing that they had, those 17 days. The story of those 17 days and the way they held together and the way they prayed for each other, the way they kept each other going, the way they shared the food, the seemingly miraculous things that happened. One of the men said he could feel a breeze coming from further below, and it seemed that a drill had broken further below and it was giving him fresh air and allowing him to breathe, and they never found the source of where this air was coming from. And he said finally it had to be the 34th miner, meaning God. Another man offered to stop eating altogether. He was the frailest of all of them. He was the man who was referred to as Butterfly Jerky, Alex Vega. He said, you know what, let's stop eating. Let's go 3 days without eating. I can do it. And he was obviously the man who was in most need. And so there was this, you know, very spiritual coming together. Much later, the men realized that that really was the most special thing that had happened to them. And that story was what they wanted to preserve as their secret until the book and eventually the film come out.
Oh, there's going to be a movie?
Yes, there is. Yes.
Oh, is anyone attached to break off and speak in Hollywood speak?
Well, Antonio Banderas is playing Mario Sepulveda.
The leader.
Yeah, the self-appointed leader. As I describe him in my book, he is the man with the heart of a dog. That's how he refers to himself. His nickname is Perri, which comes from perrito or perro or dog. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much his spirit. He is someone who's loyal and who will fight to survive. And that's what he did in the mine.
Mario Sepulveda, the self-appointed leader of the miners. How did he, Mario Sepulveda, emerge as the leader of the men?
Mario is a person of fantastic mood swings. I found out later from his wife that he was taking medication to control his mood swings. Obviously, when he was trapped in the mine, he stopped taking that medication. And so he became, how should we say, bipolar. He would make wonderful speeches to the men, and he would say, you know, we're going to get out of here. We're going to show the world. We're Chileans, you know. And so he was extremely inspirational. He was also very funny. When one of the men wouldn't get up the 16th or 17th day, he was lying on his cot. Mario started to fear for him, and his response was to kick him and said, if you don't get up, we're going to eat you. So that was Mario. And then he would also slip into these incredibly deep depressions where he would lament the cruelty of it, the unfairness of it, because he came from a very poor family. His mother died in childbirth with him. And then when they were found, he was one of the ones who said, we're going to make a lot of money out of this. And so Mario was an extremely complicated person down in the mine. I like to say that he wasn't just one Shakespearean character. He was four or different ones. You know, he was Hamlet, he was Iago, he was Prince Hal. He was definitely the personality underground.
Well, they eventually emerge, and they emerge into the glare of the world's attention. And that's when fortunes really ebb and flow, because some of them do well and some of them don't do well at all. One of the miners is actually put in a mental institution for a little while. Is it because they couldn't handle all the attention, because it divided them from their families?
Well, I think first and foremost, what they had suffered was something like a war, especially the initial collapse. Imagine being inside the earth during an earthquake. The interior structure of this mine collapsed on top of them. And then for the next 68 days, the mountain just kept on roaring periodically. So they emerged with these really deep psychic traumas. On top of that, they've got the world, and especially the Chilean government and the Chilean media, saying you're heroes. So imagine being told that you're a hero when you feel small and battered inside. And so I think that was what caused the men to suffer the most.
And then some of them, like Mario, they do well.
I would say that the ones who went back to work earliest did the best. The ones who said, you know what, I don't care if I get rich or not. I don't care about any movie money or any book money. I got to get back to work. I'm tired of sitting around the house arguing with my wife. Where can I get a job? And so a lot of those guys are the ones doing best. A few even went back underground into underground mining. So, yes, yeah, some of them are doing very well. I think many of them learned an essential lesson of life, which was just the value of family. And maybe I shouldn't have been so worried about trying to make that extra dollar that I risked my life in this mine. Maybe I should just be happy with what I have.
Well, Hector Tovar, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Hector Tovar. His new book is called Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. Well, that's it for this MLK edition of Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.